Hey, gang, this week's episode is brought to you by Royal Retros, the king of throwbacks. Hey, if you're looking for teams and leagues that don't exist anymore, but you'd like to remember them in high-quality jersey or uniform format, hey, some of those teams were legendary, some of them were disasters, but they all live at Royal Retros. Check them out. RoyalRetros.com. Use that promo code SEATS for 10% off all of your purchases. Check them out now. And now, check out this episode.
It's a two-shot foul. They indicate a two-shot intentional foul. Now, the best thing for this, if he misses the first and makes the second, here's the shot, it is around and in. 75-73. He can seal the Huskies' doom right here. If he makes this free throw, it will be all over for Northeastern. Barring a miracle, the Huskies trail by two, 4 seconds to go. Thurman has one more. And this could be the ball game right here. Here's the shot. It is up around. No good. Huskies go for the tie. Moss, 2 seconds. One. At the buzzer. Midcourt shot. He's good. It's good. Barry Moss from midcourt. Barry Moss from midcourt sends the game into overtime. Barry Moss puts the game into overtime at 75. The greatest shot ever in Northeastern history. And everybody has collapsed onto the floor. I don't believe it. Barry Moss from midcourt ties the game at 75. It's the miracle of Cabot Jim. The game is not over yet, but the Huskies are back in it. Everybody has poured onto the floor, and Holy Cross is absolutely stunned. Perry Moss, who 2 years ago hit a 35-footer against Army to beat them by one at the buzzer, 62-61, has done it again 2 years later. This time in the finals, Moss from midcourt hits the shot to tie it up. 75-75, we go to overtime. What a moment. What a moment.
Welcome to Good Seats Still Available, a curious little podcast devoted to exploring what used to be in professional sports. Here's your host, Tim Hanlon.
All right, happy hoops, everybody. It's Tim Hanlon. I am your chief cook and bottle washer around here. You have found Good Seats Still Available, the curious little podcast that is devoted to what used to be in professional sports. I'll put professional in quotes this week. We thank you for finding us and putting us in your earbuds. I say professional, of course, because what is the NCAA basketball tournament and NCAA sports generally in the world of NIL and gambling and big money and television and all that kind of stuff? Well, it's I don't know. I think this March Madness will be kind of the last of its breed. It'll be interesting to see what the NCAA football situation looks like this coming fall as well. But we instead of yelling at the clouds, we're going to look back into some of the more memorable moments in sports history, mostly forgotten. And the college game certainly does capture our attention every once in a while. And when we have an excuse to do it, we will. And this week, our old pal Clayton Truder has shown up on our door once again after a 2.5 year absence. You may remember him from our previous conversation, episode number 237, when we were talking about the history of professional sports in Atlanta. Well, he is back with a brand new book that's really interesting, a great thread of history in college basketball. It is called Boston Ball, Rick Pitino, Jim Calhoun, Gary Williams, and the Forgotten Cradle of Basketball Coaches. And the little sound there that we heard at the beginning kind of gives us a little bit of a tone there. And the excitement is palpable as we dial it back to the 1981 ECAC North championship game between Northeastern, the Huskies of Northeastern, and the Holy Cross Crusaders. And the call in that game, it was Steve Berkowitz with the frantic call with his color commentator, Paul Porter, at the microphones. And this was the championship game of what was then known as the ECAC North, now known as the America East Conference. And this is kind of sort of the centerpiece of our conversation. Northeastern, coached at the time by a young and hungry Jim Calhoun, a number of years before he absconded to UConn and became the dean of college coaches, certainly there winning a bunch of NCAA championships and cementing UConn's legacy, which continues today. This tournament, the heavily favored UConn Huskies, defending champs they are. Jim Calhoun, foundational in rehabilitating that program at UConn. But before then, he was coaching it up at Northeastern. And this ECAC North competition gives you a sense that this is the days before, well, actually, this is just after the Big East's formation. But there were still a lot of teams up and down the East Coast that were kind of flailing around for, I guess you could call it sort of a conference solidification. It was a relatively ragtag process in the 1970s and before for East Coast basketball teams to get into the NCAA tournament and get on people's national radars for such. And I think a lot of people sort of lose track of that relatively balkanized kind of existence that was the case in Northeast college basketball. The ACAC was a sort of this amalgam of various teams up and down the coast that would meet in these tournaments in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And the winners of these things would effectively get, I guess you could call it a quasi-automatic berth into the fast-growing NCAA tournament. So in this case, 1981, Jim Calhoun's Huskies were not only champions of this ECAC North, but also got the nod to go into the tournament. And they won a game in that tournament. I don't think Northeastern had been in a tournament either in their history or for a long time before. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question, but they, after having defeated Holy Cross, they went on to win a game in the tournament, and they got crushed by Utah in their second round match. But no question, Jim Calhoun was very much an instigator of that success. And we also talk about, though, two other coaches that were coaching in and around his time, Jim Calhoun's at Northeastern, Rick Pitino being one, hooping it up in Boston University from 1978 to 83. Certainly very well traveled, but people don't remember really that this was the Boston University experience was the first time head coaching experience at the collegiate level of the top tier for Rick Pitino, who's gone to many different stops, some controversially and currently now at St. John's. But Rick Pitino, part of this threaded Boston ball conversation coming up with Clayton Truter. And last but not least is an equally legendary coach. His name is Gary Williams, who went on to great fame and solidifying the program at Maryland, winning a ton of titles there, coaches of the year awards and all that kind of stuff. And people fail to remember that Boston College during the 1970s as an assistant and during the bulk of, the first half, I would say the 1980s, 82 through 86, Gary Williams was making a scene for himself in the Northeast with the Eagles of Boston College. And that's kind of the thread as we kind of throw back to a kinder, gentler time, perhaps, in the NCAA basketball tournament history and the various things that were going on in the Northeast. This is pre-Big East. We get into sort of that that tributary, that sort of foundational pre-Big East kind of realm. This is before other leagues like the Northeast Conference and the America East and the Metro Athletic Conference. These are all conferences that sort of got their roots, their origins from what was going on in the ECAC. And our conversation this week is the Boston version, the centricity of Boston, of that ECAC, as we talk about the old-time college basketball scene and some of the legendary characters from the coaching ranks that came out of that, Rick Pitino, Jim Calhoun, and Gary Williams. Our conversation coming up with Clayton Truter come in 1 second. The book, again, is called Boston Ball. Rick Pitino, Jim Calhoun, Gary Williams, and the Forgotten Cradle of Basketball Coaches. It is available now wherever you find good books. It is published by our friends at the University of Nebraska Press. And the easiest way, of course, for you to get it, if you don't want to go to your local bookseller down the street and have them order it for you, is to go to our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. Search up this episode numbered, what the heck is it now? 342, my goodness, with Clayton Truter. And you'll find a convenient link or two or three that will whisk you away to Amazon. You can get the Kindle version, the hardcover version, whatever you'd like, and we'll get a couple of shekels of referral love in the process. We thank you for doing that. And of course, we thank you for staying tuned, because here comes our chat. We had it about a month and a half ago. Sorry we couldn't get it to you sooner, but here's my chat with Clayton Truter. Let's talk about Boston and college basketball in the late 70s, early 1980s, back in a kinder, gentler time. Here's our conversation. Please, as always, enjoy. Well, tell us, since it's been about 2.5 years or so since you've been on this show talking about Atlanta sports, tell us what you've been up to and how you veered into this really interesting take on, well, I'm not sure it's fully about Boston and basketball. I think it's kind of a wider story, right? And I think we'll get into some of the intricacies, but I think the Big East, you know, is sort of part of all this, the predecessor of all that, the NCAA tournament, and these three guys who, you know, are legends all in the realm of college basketball coaching. But give us a little bit of an update about what you've been doing over the last couple of years and the entree into this story.
Well, this book started the day I submitted Loserville. I knew I didn't just want to write one book in my life, and I felt like I had to start immediately. And it's still when the pandemic was really, like, it was before the vaccine came out, so it's still, you know, still definitely like the core of the pandemic. And I felt this is a good time to start another book. And back when I was in graduate school, my Loserville about Atlanta was a product of my doctoral dissertation. And I went to a lot of college basketball games in Boston. I would go, you know, if I had a night off, I'd go over to BU to a game. I'd go to Harvard. I'd go to Northeastern. I went to grad school at BC. So that was right around the corner. And it occurred to me back when I was in grad school that three different coaches who had Hall of Fame careers, Rick Pitino at Boston University, Jim Calhoun at Northeastern, and Gary Williams at Boston College, all began their careers at roughly the same time in Boston in the late 70s and early 1980s. And it surprised me that nobody had really gone in depth about this at all. And at some point between having that little kernel of an idea and beginning the book in 2021, I read John Feinstein's book, The Legends Club, which was about the relationships among Jim Valvano, Dean Smith, and Mike Krzyzewski all down in North Carolina. And it occurred to me that a similar book could be written about what was happening in Boston during the late 70s and early 80s. So I kind of took the structure that Feinstein used to tell these three stories in an interlocking fashion, and I adopted that to the Boston story. And once my agent was able to get me a book deal for this new book, Boston Ball, I got to calling people and I cranked out like 95 interviews in a 3-month period for the book. I talked to a lot of players on the different teams who played for Pitino, Calhoun, and Williams. I talked to players from opposing programs. I talked to a lot of athletic department personnel too, because they were really the best help in terms of getting a sense of the context of what's happening in college basketball with the conference shifts, with the change in the tournament, some of the rule changes in this time period. I think a lot of the players were very focused on, particularly on their playing career, but talking to sports information directors from a lot of the different schools, particularly schools that were ECAC schools, who ended up kind of in the mix of trying to find a conference in the late 70s and early 80s, was particularly helpful. I got to know a guy named John Maddock, who was the sports information director at Canisius in Buffalo, and later the athletic director there. And he set me up with a Zoom meeting like 2 weeks after I started this with 10 different sports information directors from the same time period, from all around New England and upstate New York. And talking with them really helped me, I guess, develop the architecture of what's happening more broadly in college basketball. So getting all those. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was gonna say. So your angle was these three guys and what's in the water in Boston. Is that kind of the focus? And then the rest of it kind of just sprung, because arguably that story couldn't be told unless the background of where they were coaching at that time in the late 70s. That just opens up a whole Pandora's box of the state of college basketball, what was going on the East Coast at the time. Was that kind of the narrative?
Absolutely. I mean, I didn't want the book simply to be about this being the rise of three coaches. That seems more like, I don't know, like, I guess a human interest story on ESPN Sunday morning or something, which is fine. But I mean,
more
I'm trained
coincidence more than anything else.
More coincidence than anything else. Yeah, I wanted to tell a broader story to situate what's happening within the landscape of college basketball. I thought there was something to stylistically. They were all playing a little bit differently than the other teams in that time period. They were all playing pressure defense, playing fast breaking, up-tempo offenses in an era that was very much dominated by the big men. So not that they were consciously doing this, but there's these coaches are all taking advantage of these opportunities to coach in relative anonymity. I mean, it's a little different at Boston College because they're in the Big East, but even there, their fan base was basically just alumni and then current students. Coaching with a little bit, I guess, not as intense a lens on them, they were able to try some new things, in many ways, old things in college basketball, things that had been done back in the 40s and 50s. And it became the model for the kind of small ball that a lot of the major programs played in the late 20th and early 21st century. So it's about some of the changes in college basketball, as well as the growth of these coaches. And I try to situate it within the broader landscape of college basketball, I would say, broadly in the, what's going on in Eastern basketball in this time period, which is just utter chaos in a lot of ways.
All right. Well, so let's backtrack for a second. Then I want to get into the three individuals here, because their individual stories are key to this too. But let's go back, right? So I think a lot of people of a certain generation, maybe even two, think the Big East kind of existed from time immemorial once the basketball was sort of, you know, played on the collegiate level back in the 20s and 30s for the first time, right? And a big stage. And of course, 1979 is when the Big East got formed. Before that, though, where a lot of this origin story gets rooted, right, with these mm-hmm. guys, is the East Coast, or the Northeast in particular, was, how can I best describe it? Almost like a college basketball backwater, or it wasn't that the game wasn't sort of like legit on the college level, but it was also sort of, I don't know, was it under the radar? Was it part of the national tournament scene? It wasn't getting a whole lot of spotlight, perhaps, for relative to other regions of the country. Is that right?
Without question, because you don't have the major conferences there. I think in part it's just the nature of a lot of the schools in the Northeast. A lot of the best schools in terms of basketball were Catholic schools who didn't fit as easily into, say, the Big Ten, the SEC-style conference, where it's a lot of these land-grant flagship state universities. So basketball was always a little different regionally in the East. I think part of it goes back to the 1950s after the point-shaving scandals, that a lot of the best talent in the Northeast ends up going elsewhere. Of course, with McGuire going down to North Carolina and a lot of these players from New York, from Philadelphia, playing at Southern schools, playing at Big Ten schools. So you have a bit of a drain of talent from the Northeast in the 50s, 60s, and 70s as well. I think also because you just don't get these major conferences formed, there's this kind of amorphous thing that is Eastern basketball for a long time. And those teams would get bids to the tournament. There would be a New England bid for the tournament, for example, in the 50s and 60s. I've been writing in recent years quite a bit about UConn basketball for a blog that focuses on that. And I write historical pieces. And on a number of occasions, UConn would have the best record in New England and get what was, it wasn't a conference bid, but it was called the New England bid in the tournament when it was a 25-team affair. So it was a little bit different in terms of the focus. There's also the aspect of a lot of the teams in the Northeast were used to going to the NIT and perceiving that as the best tournament in the country. Between 1954 with LaSalle and 1985 in Georgetown, you don't have a team that's from the Northeast that wins the national title in college basketball. There's a bunch of winners of the NIT who are from New England, from the Northeast during that time period. But I think the focus is a little bit different too. There's almost sort of the major conference focus being on the NCAA tournament, whereas in the Northeast, there's a lot of focus on the NIT as being the postseason prize. So I mean, it's not exactly a backwater. I think it's almost more on parallel tracks to what's going on in terms of major college basketball.
I guess it's as clearly I'm more of a modern sort of gaze backwards, right? And cynical at that, right? Which is, I'm guilty as charged. But it's hard to believe, right? Because I think you sort of grow up in this era. And I went to Georgetown undergrad and was there for, one of the championships and one of the final losses in person at the Rupp Arena for losing to Villanova. But we won't talk about that. It's kind of mind-boggling though that you just said it before, one bid for New England. I mean, you know, there's plenty of quality basketball played up there and one school, right? I mean, it's just it is what it was, right? But maybe you can kind of give us a little bit of more sort of insight as to what the mid to late 1970s looked like and what this ECAC thing was that kind of helped, I guess, shepherd or shape some other pathways into what was a tournament that was becoming much more like a true national championship. It wasn't even a league, this ECAC.
Yes, I'll preface all of this by saying I think I'm 42 years old right now. I grew up as a little kid from the time I'm like five, paying a lot of attention to the NCAA tournament. I think because I grew up in a period, and you're a few years older than me, but you essentially grew up in a period where there's a lot of stability in college basketball. College basketball is getting a lot of national attention. I think the way things are when you're a kid seems like the natural order of things. And we're growing up in a period when there's a lot of stability in major college basketball in the 80s and 90s. We see a lot of chaos in recent times. I would say what's been happening with the conference realignment and everything going on in college basketball in recent years related to the role of players in regards to pay and everything, in some ways, harkens back to what college basketball was like from roughly the 1950s through the 1970s, where there was a lot of chaos in terms of the form of the NCAA tournament. The ECAC, the Eastern Collegiate Athletic Conference, was an amorphous group of schools as small as, say, like St. Anselm's in New Hampshire, as large as, say, Rutgers, just a huge range of schools in New England, in the mid-Atlantic states, all the way down to South Carolina, I believe, historically, schools were members of this. And essentially, it was a subsidiary conference for schools that had another conference they played most sports in, but offered them a pathway to a national turn to the NCAA tournament in their respective sports. So, for example, if you played in some kind of mid-Atlantic conference in every other sport, but you played hockey, you know, your Cornell or something like this, Cornell was a part of the ECAC because the Ivy League didn't have hockey. So it was an opportunity for them to get connected to a national tournament. And it's sort of the second conference for a lot of schools, in addition to whatever conference they played most of their other sports in. For whatever reason, the ECAC became the basketball conference for almost everybody in the East, because there weren't a lot of major conferences around in the region. And in the early 70s, you have a transformation in college basketball, a move away from what were called the University Division, which is now Division I, and the College Division. In college basketball, which is now, I guess, a mix of Division II and Division III, you have a formation of more modern versions of Division I, Division II, and then eventually in the late 70s, Division III college athletics, and the formation of more modern tournament structures. And beginning in 1975, you have a 32-team NCAA men's basketball tournament, one where it's not simply the automatic bids anymore. There start to be some at-large teams who get bids to the NCAA tournament. And as this is the case, the East, which had these sort of, I guess, earmarked, if not formalized bids for conferences, like the New England bid that UConn would get, or Rhode Island or someone like that, the teams in New England were concerned that they were going to get shut out of the NCAA tournament. That, say, for example, they'd rather have two teams from the ACC, possibly three, you know, have Maryland, UNC, Duke, rather than having a New England bid in the NCAA tournament, perceiving these ACC teams as stronger. So the ECAC created specific tournament, four different specific tournaments, regional tournaments, a New England tournament, an upstate New York tournament, a metro tournament, which meant basically the New York metro area, and a southern tournament, which was, you know, there were teams in Pennsylvania in it, teams in Virginia, teams in Maryland. It was everything to the south of that was part of the ECAC. And they had sort of almost like conference, four different conference tournaments, which started in 1975 to create this pathway, sort of like a conference tournament to the NCAAs. And this format lasts from 1975 until roughly 1982. It shrinks every year because teams from these particular four ECAC sections all start to leave to join newly formed conferences. So, for example, the ECAC New England had teams like Boston College and UConn, who end up in the Big East. They have teams like Northeastern and Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont, who end up in what a conference which becomes, which is now America East, was called the ECAC North for a while. You have this ECAC Upstate, which has Syracuse leave to join the Big East. You have St. Bonaventure joins what eventually becomes the Atlantic 10. So this ECAC structure is a marriage of convenience, these tournaments that last for about 7 years, and there's fewer tournaments each year. Like at one point, like the Upstate New York tournament, once a bunch of teams had left that, joined up with the Southern tournament to play for one tournament bid. So it was the Upstate / South ECAC tournament they held for a couple of years. So you had schools like Colgate playing against the likes of Old Dominion in an ECAC tournament just because they needed an opportunity to have this conference tournament format so people could play their way into the NCAAs. It disappears once everybody's basically into a new conference, and the format that people who grew up in the 80s and 90s are used to is in place by 81 or 82.
Yeah, again, by today's standards, that seems just just crazy, but it was kind of the way it was. Was this being replicated in other parts of the country that were also, shall we say, underrepresented in terms of their feeders into the national tournament? Was New England and the Northeast unique in that regard?
I think it was anomalous. Yeah, I think most of the country, even sparsely populated places, formed themselves into conferences pretty easily and stuck with that. There also were just, I mean, in the Great Lakes region, there are certainly a number of Catholic colleges, but having the proliferation of them in the Northeast just gave college basketball a little bit different feel than you would have, say, in prairie states or in the Western states. There just weren't a lot of these schools kicking around in the same way there were in Massachusetts and New York State, New Jersey. It seems to me that this kind of format was not really going on elsewhere, although I could be wrong.
Why do you think, though? Not arrogance, I guess, but why do you think it took so long, I guess, perhaps, for this region to kind of gel and become, you know, united, if you will, in terms of being a force versus or competitive with the rest of the country from a conference perspective?
I think in a strange way, it's a product of UCLA's dominance of college basketball. That UCLA was clearly the best team in the country for very many years in the 60s and 70s. Before that, I think the idea that the NCAA tournament was clearly superior to the NIT was not something that was a widely held opinion in the Northeast.
And the NIT, very, very popular, obviously, New York-centric, et cetera, right?
Absolutely. And here's the thing. Would you rather play a tournament game at Madison Square Garden or play in Provo, Utah, or play in, you know, at Washington State or something? It's a much more prestigious thing to play at Ned Irish's tournament there at Madison Square Garden. I mean, really from the late 30s, I think really until the early 70s, there's a bit of a contest in terms of which is a more prestigious tournament to be in. Eventually, the NCAA wins out for a lot of reasons. I think television probably as prominently as anything, that the networks ended up, UCLA became a brand that they could build around. And it was whoever is going to challenge UCLA that year in the NCAA tournament became a very, very attractive television property. I think that in some ways leads to the conference formation. In one of the years in the early 70s, Providence also gets to the Final Four, challenges UCLA. They were clearly the best team in the East. And that in many ways leads Dick Gavitt, who's the father of the Big East, to get the idea, let's get our games on television. Let's get the best teams in the Northeast together. Let's get access to the best arenas in all the major Northeastern cities. And that becomes the building blocks of what becomes the Big East as well. So in some ways, it's these broader structural forces that I think force the East to embrace the NCAA tournament and its structures, as opposed to its own. John Gassaway's fantastic history of Catholic college basketball, he talks about there being this core sort of prairie tradition of college basketball, which is built around the conferences and going to the NCAA tournament versus what he calls the parish tradition, which, whether it's a Catholic school or not, so many of the schools in the Northeast that the focus was on getting to the NIT, playing in those games, and that being the way you build your program up, as opposed to trying to get one of these bids to this tournament against teams from states you've never been to, kind of thing, if you're in the Northeast. So I think it's a case of parallel tracks, as I was saying earlier.
All right, I want to get to these guys in a second, but how much was football sort of part of this too? Because obviously the Northeast is by comparison, right? Not a smaller amount of Division I teams at the collegiate level playing football. Only a handful of teams relative, say, to big pockets of the rest of the country, the Southwest, the Southeast, of course, even on the West Coast, right? Did that have something to do with the fact that those conferences were a little bit more set and able to kind of service basketball as well as football, or uniquely maybe versus, say, what was going on in the Northeast or the East Coast, where there was a relative dearth of top-tier college football programs?
I think you hit it at the head. If you're the Big Ten, if you're the SEC, it's football is the straw that stirs the drink. If you're St. Francis in New York State, if you're St. John's, if you're Villanova, you may have a football team, but that is not the focus of your athletic endeavor. Your basketball team is your premier program. And I think as a result of that, it just gave a different tenor to the role college basketball played more broadly within an institution in these smaller Northeastern schools.
Well, ironically, and the theme that played later on in the Big East's demise and then rebirth, right, was sort of the football sort of taking over and arguably Big East one, the first version, but not being able to sort of adapt, if you will, with enough schools to make it sort of worth television's while. And that's a whole nother sort of kettle of fish, but it's clear though, but it's also maybe part of the unique, and maybe we can segue into these three sort of legends of the game. There's a flavor, right? I mean, you grow up in the Northeast and, you know, with the heritage of the NIT, this, you know, Marty Glickman calling games and CCNY against NYU. And, you know, you go way back, right? I mean, the metropolitan area in particular, right? Always a big hardwood locus, obviously the Philadelphia area, Boston, certainly. And, you know, all up and down the East Coast, the hell the game kind of was birthed in the Northeast as well. And I guess it's almost sort of a quaint charm, if you will, to some of these smaller schools and big schools kind of mixing it up in their own unique East Coast kind of way. And there's probably a little bit of pride in terms of the, you were mentioning it before, sort of the style, and certainly, you know, lots of urban areas that are feeding a lot of these schools with kids of high quality.
Without question. And I think it's to some extent the reason the Big East tournament became such a big deal is it replaced the NIT's cultural role in the Northeast, that it became the weekend of basketball in the region in the same way the NIT was for an earlier generation. That we may not have the national championship, but we have the championship of us, and all the people from the different cities in the Northeast would come together for the tournament. It was a regional bragging rights thing that in some ways I think was as significant as what happened in the later national tournament.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the NIT and sort of its waywardness in a few minutes. But describe for me, though, these three characters. I mean, Jim Calhoun, Rick Pitino, and Gary Williams, one of whom is still coaching today. Although, as we record this this week, I mean, Rick Pitino is pretty much lamenting his days right now at St. John's, and maybe ruining the day that he decided to come back and try to tackle a top tier Division I team and going back home, so to speak. But give me a little bit of a sense of these guys. They're all to a person, East Coast, Northeast, born and bred, and clearly grew up in this environment. Small schools, high schools, and smaller colleges and stuff. Maybe a little background for each of them, maybe not necessarily in that order if you don't want to.
Sure. I'll start with Gary Williams, who I think is the least known of the three. And for everyone I interviewed about Gary Williams, I would ask them to describe the man, and everybody paused for a second and said, "He's intense," was the way they described him. That he was like that when he was 18 years old, that he was just this guy who was sweating through his clothes with anxiety about what's going on in basketball, whether he's playing in a college game, whether he's playing, you know, whether he's coaching at Maryland, whether he's coaching at Boston College in a game against St. Anselm's or something. I mean, he just took the game incredibly seriously from a very young age. He grows up right outside of Philadelphia in suburban New Jersey. He ends up playing at Maryland and is an excellent college point guard, great defensive player, gets into high school coaching. He wins a state championship in New Jersey, and in a school in Camden, and gets into the college ranks as a result of his friendship with Tom Davis, who went on to have a great career coaching at Boston College and Stanford and Iowa, among other places. Davis had been a graduate assistant at Maryland when Gary Williams was there, and Davis had gotten the job at Lafayette, which was getting pounded by the likes of Delaware and Temple and a lot of schools in the mid-Atlantic region in the 70s when Davis took over. And he wanted to bring Williams, who he thought was the best, I guess, the best coaching prospect among the players he'd had at Maryland, along with him to Lafayette, and convinces Williams to take the job. He takes a pay cut to go from being a high school teacher with a, you know, good paying, I mean, not a good paying, but a steady union job, good benefits, all that kind of stuff, to being a college assistant. When Gary Williams gets to Lafayette, he learns that he has to also be the soccer coach. His job is a halftime appointment as a basketball coach in the wintertime, and in the fall, he is the soccer coach, a sport he had never played in his life. He had never kicked a soccer ball before he got to Lafayette College. And he got there, he leveled with the players, told them, "You need to teach me soccer. I know about getting you guys in condition." So he basically relied on this. He's a 25, 26-year-old coach, relies on the seniors on his team to sort of teach him soccer. And he's their head soccer coach for 6 years. He has like a 500 record, has a close to a 500 record as a college soccer coach, despite having never played the game, never really seen the game before he became the coach. At the same time, Lafayette is serving as this laboratory for the kind of up-tempo, aggressive offense and defensive styles that Davis and then Williams, to an even greater extent, adapted during his coaching tenure. Lafayette is pressing and trapping and incredibly aggressive against a lot of these more prestigious programs from Philly and Maryland and Delaware and the like, and they win the Eastern Athletic Conference a couple of times to get to the NIT. Williams follows Davis along to Boston College, where they start to institute the same program, get things rolling there. BC, in the time when Davis and then Williams are there, they go to the Sweet 16 four out of 5 years at one point, twice when Gary Williams is the coach. So Williams is a guy who is willing to, he thought he was going to be a lifelong teacher and high school coach. He took a chance on it and ended up having a fantastic career as a college coach, eventually ending up back at his alma mater and winning a national championship.
Give me a sense of BC though. So BC at this time, where were they in the ECAC / Big East firmament during Williams's tenure there? Because he was assistant at BC for what, about two seasons or so in the late 70s, and then he came back as head coach in the early to mid 1980s.
Yes, yeah, he went and coached at American. Obviously. He got them to the NIT.
Yeah.
Boston College, this is very much the pre-Doug Flutie Boston College. BC is a selective Jesuit college just outside of Boston. You know, mostly Irish Catholic kids going there. It's not the institution the way it's, you know, perceived as being an elite kind of university now. It wasn't quite there. In terms of basketball, they'd been pretty good in the 50s. They had a couple of good teams in the 70s. This was hardly a powerhouse. The New England Catholic powerhouse of that era was Holy Cross. Holy Cross won the ECAC New England Championship in two of the 5 years they held it. They had a guy named Ronnie Perry, who was probably the best college basketball player in New England of the 70s. At least of the last half of the 70s. Holy Cross was the team that was the power in New England. They'd won a championship. You know, you had Cousy and Tommy Heinsohn and all these great players. They played at the Boston Garden a lot more than BC did when the Big East was being formed. This was the school that was asked to join. They turned it down, thinking that the they wanted to focus more on the academic mission of the school and joining this new kind of powerhouse sports conference. BC happily picked up the torch and became the Boston area representative in the conference. It just so happened that with Tom Davis and then Gary Williams there, you had some great coaches who went out recruited incredibly effectively, built a really, I think, the secret power of the early Big East. They're the regular season champion twice in this era, and they're the team nobody wanted to play. I mean, they were smaller than Georgetown and Villanova and all these powerful programs they were playing, but they just found a way to compete with everybody by playing so aggressively night in and night out.
Was Williams caught up in any of the pre-Big East point shaving stuff that was going on or that happened at BC, which is obviously a dark point in that program's history? Because he was there, or had he left by then?
He was
maybe a little bit of that story.
Yeah, I mean, he's gone by the time that gets going. I mean, the BC point shaving scandal, you have three players that are caught up in it. The guy who's most involved is a guy named Rick Kuhn, who is from Pittsburgh. Met a guy who was like a mob connected dude who hooked him up with the Henry Hill of Goodfellas fame and the New York crime families, and Kuhn ends up contacting allegedly a couple of his teammates, his roommate Tim Sweeney, Jim Sweeney, who was the point guard, and Ernie Cobb, who was the team's best scorer. The degree to which games were actually affected, it was affected as a matter of dispute. It's clear there were some connections and that there was some money exchanged. Kuhn is the only one of the three who gets convicted in court of involvement. It blows up this happens during the 78-79 season. It blows up in 1981 when there's a Sports Illustrated cover called Anatomy of a Scandal, in which Henry Hill of Goodfellas fame tells his stories of being involved in point shaving at BC. That really, in many ways, leads to Davis leaving. I think he just was very uncomfortable with, I mean, Davis had nothing to do with it. There's no indication that anybody other than these three guys knew anything about it at BC until the story in Sports Illustrated comes out. The BC players for the next year, every time they go into a Big East arena, people are spraying shaving cream and throwing razors and stuff at them, mock them as they're coming on the court. They go out and they get to the Elite Eight that year, so they had a fantastic season. Gary Williams sort of leaves right before this gets going, and he comes back for the 82-83 season after most of it is through. There's an ongoing trial for Ernie Cobb, one of the three guys who was not convicted of involvement. Kuhn is the only guy who's convicted, and he got sent to jail for, I mean, I think he served four, but he got sentenced to 10 years. It was a fairly draconian sentence in my mind for what was involved in this. But I mean, certainly the knowledge of the scandal was out there, but I think for the most part, it was over by the time Williams takes over. I address it in like a 3-4 page section in the book, because it's not really per se what the story's about, but it's something I had to address just because when people think Boston College basketball, it's one of the things that obviously comes to mind.
Yeah, and he obviously went back, right? So he took his first head coaching job with American in 78. But you know, the Boston College that he returned to, not only in the wake of that scandal, but frankly, the footprint of what Boston College was now part of in the Big East, right? It's almost like night and day. I mean, you take a 1977-78 basketball season and you transpose that with what the Big East what was becoming. And I mean, look, the 1984, 1985, you had three Big East teams in the Final Four. I mean, you can't describe just how night and day that transformation, courtesy of the Big East, was. And then for Boston College, at least for the first couple of years of that period of time, right, was it's incredibly different than what he left. I'm certain.
Absolutely. That 1985 Final Four with the three Big East teams in the Final Four with Villanova and Georgetown and St. John's, BC beats two of those teams. They lose by one to Georgetown when they play them. The other team in the Final Four is Memphis State, who BC lost to at the buzzer in the Sweet 16. So BC was a team that could hang with everybody that was in that fantastic Final Four in 1985.
All right, what's this? Royal Retros. All right, longtime fans of this show may remember a little site that we used to promote the heck out of called 503 Sports. Well, not only are they still around, they are now known as Royal Retros. RoyalRetros.com, the king of throwbacks. And like the name implies, the highest quality jerseys and hats and apparel and all kinds of stuff related to various teams and leagues and situations that we love to obsess about here on this show. And I'm talking about getting jerseys with your name and number on the back of them, customized to your liking for the WHA or old NHL hockey teams that may not exist anymore. Perhaps it's a Federal League team from way back or a Negro League team. Maybe you're just enamored with the various football leagues of the past, like the Arena League or the All-American Football Conference or the original UFL, United Football League. Yes, you can get all of those teams in all kinds of colors, away jerseys, home jerseys. You want to put your name on them. You want to make sure you got the official patch on the side. All of those things and more at RoyalRetros.com. And I'm not kidding, friends. You go there, you want to find that Cleveland Barons jersey to wear and show. Hey, you're maybe a Colorado Avalanche fan and you want to represent the Quebec Nordiques from where they came. In the arena to show your heritage and your love and knowledge of the history of that franchise, you can do that and more. And I'm talking across football and basketball and baseball and hockey and you name it, all kinds of great stuff for you to find and buy and purchase and wear proudly from Royal Retros. That's RoyalRetros.com. And of course, we have a promo code for you. We want to save you money from all these great things. And here's that code. It's SEATS, S-E-A-T-S, promo code SEATS for all of your purchases at RoyalRetros.com. Check them out. You'll be glad you did. We love them. And our friend Destin Alameda there out in Portland, Oregon, we appreciate his and their sponsorship of this show. And now, back to our conversation. All right, so let's pivot from Gary Williams. Pick your poison here, Calhoun or Patino? Maybe Patino.
I'll say Patino for last.
Okay, most people would like to. But that's okay. Different reasons, but Calhoun, right? He's another East Coast guy, right? And has he gets his chops. I would say toiling in obscurity, but describe his Northeastern experiences, because he was there for quite some time. I think people sort of get lost in the fact that he was not just this UConn icon.
I would say toiling in obscurity completely. He gets there. They're a school that is just moving up to Division One. Jim Calhoun grows up in Braintree, Massachusetts, just south of Boston. His father dies when he's like 14 years old. He's the man of the household at that point. While other people were, you know, spending high school going out and getting milkshakes with their best girl, he was breaking rocks at a foundry. He was helping to carve headstones as a teenager in Quincy, Mass, and ends up delaying going to college for a couple years to help support his mother and his younger sisters. And eventually he gets seen in a rec league basketball game by a guy at American International College, which is out near Springfield. And takes a college scholarship. He's a little older and plays college ball, becomes a high school coach, eventually ends up in Dedham, Mass, which is near Boston as well, takes over a program that had won one game in the previous two seasons. 2 years later, he has them in the state semifinal. They go 22-1. He'd had a high school coach in Braintree named Fred Herget, who had sort of like a 365-day program for his players. Herget was the head of the rec department in Braintree, Mass, and all of his players were the guys who like worked at the local tennis courts or parks or something around the city. And every day he'd go around monitoring them and he would give them a different task to do. So he had a very clear sense of attention to detail, was very focused on teaching pressure defense. Calhoun brought that with him into coaching and helped turn his teams around very quickly. He also got a job in Dedham's town's rec department, also when he was a high school teacher, and was on these kids 365 days a year to help them improve their basketball skills. And having such a great season at Dedham, he caught the attention of the athletic director at Northeastern. Northeastern was in a bind in September 1972, needing a head basketball coach for a season that would begin in 2 weeks. Northeastern had been a... is was Northeastern's now become an excellent university in Boston. I mean, an excellent university. It's always well ranked in U.S. News and World Report and all that kind of stuff. At the time, it was essentially a commuter school. It was a very inexpensive college. It was a very large college. Had like 50,000 students. Had no on-campus housing until the very late 1960s. So it was a very different feel than it is now, where it's a large, fairly exclusive private university. Calhoun, or the basketball program at Northeastern, had been a strong one in the college division, essentially Division II. They got to the NCAA tournament a bunch of times. They decided to move up to Division I, the university division, for the 1972-1973 season. Just as they were making this move to Division I, they went through two head coaches very quickly. They had a guy named Dick Dukeshire, who'd been the coach since the late 1950s, who took a job coaching the Greek national team for the 1972 Olympics, and coached them to, I think they were like 10th or something like that in the Olympics. He got sick while he was over there and had to, he was going to come back after a 1 year sabbatical and take back over the program, but he got sick and couldn't do it. Their coach, who'd been the interim coach, a guy named Jim Bowman, was a 30-year-old guy who'd played at Northeastern under Dukeshire during the 60s. His dream had been to join the FBI. Right before the 72 season started, in September 72, he got a letter inviting him to the FBI Academy. And 30 years old was the maximum age for joining the FBI Academy. So he decided that joining the FBI would be a more stable career path than coaching a basketball program that may not succeed at the Division I level. So he took that job. They were scrambling for a coach and hired Calhoun. He comes in his first year and goes 19-7 against the Division I schedule. They'd previously been playing a lot of Division II programs. And Calhoun ends up coaching there for the next 14 years. He's the head coach at Northeastern from 72 to 86. Things fade a little bit in terms of that beginner's luck. He happened to have a good core of returning players then. Throughout the 70s, he struggles to develop recruiting pipelines. They're 500 for a bunch of the decade. It's really at decade's end when he really starts to build Northeastern into a power. He builds a pipeline out to Pittsburgh, he builds one to Maryland, and gets many of the top players who end up leading Northeastern to the tournament so many times in the early to mid 80s. In 5 out of 6 years under Calhoun, from 81 to 86, they go to the NCAA tournament. They scored three consecutive first round upsets in the NCAAs. They were sort of like what Gonzaga was like in the late 90s. I would say Northeastern was like in the early to mid 80s. They were the mid-major team that nobody wanted to face. In their first year in the tournament, they got one of these automatic ECAC bids that was still in place. The ECAC New England had merged and had moved to, had evolved into something called the ECAC North. So they got an automatic bid. At that point, the Big East did not have an automatic bid yet. So Syracuse won the Big East tournament in 1981. They didn't go to the tournament. Northeastern did. Boeheim and the Syracuse guys all made a huge stink about it. Like, who the hell is Northeastern? Why are they in the NCAA tournament? Well, they went out and they scored a first round upset against Virginia Commonwealth. So they certainly showed that they belonged. But to how quickly things changed in college basketball, that a Big East team did not get an automatic bid, but little Northeastern did at that point.
How much was there amongst what's the question? The question is, are these teams playing each other in Boston? Is there a bean pot tournament, if you will, for these clubs akin to what goes on in hockey? And I guess I would throw in BU with Patino at the time too. Do these teams play each other on a regular basis or preseason and that kind of stuff, or are they kind of in their own sort of little worlds?
There was a formal beanpot until the mid 1970s, which they would play at the Garden. It was nothing like the hockey beanpot, which was a raucous thing with a full house with students from all the schools. There'd be like 1,000 people that would attend this, in part because the basketball programs just weren't that strong in the city. They canceled it and never brought it back, despite efforts to do so from time to time over the last, say, 40 years. Nevertheless, BU and Northeastern had a very strong rivalry, and they ended up in the same conference, the ECAC North. So Patino and Calhoun's teams would be playing each other 2 or 3 times a year. depending on what happened in the conference tournament. So a very strong rivalry developed between them. Those were two clearly the two best teams in the ECAC North. That league was, it was Northeastern, it was BU, it was the Northern New England State Colleges, a couple of seemingly random schools in upstate New York, and then two of the three Buffalo schools, Niagara and Canisius. BU and Northeastern were clearly the top programs in that league, and a very strong rivalry, one that got very personal in a lot of ways between Pitino and Calhoun, later Calhoun and Jarvis. Met Mike Jarvis, who coached at BU, developed in that era. BC was always a little apart because they were in the Big East. I mean, every time that BC played BU or Northeastern in this time period, they won. So they didn't. I mean, it wasn't, they weren't quite on the same level. I mean, it was close a few times, particularly against Northeastern in the mid-80s.
Well, no,
But BC was always, yeah.
yeah.
Oh,
Well,
go
I
ahead.
also imagine too that the television. I mean, this you can't ignore the TV's presence and stuff. The birth of ESPN, the need for programming, and the Big East taking advantage of that, if you will, literally and figuratively. There was no question that the media footprint of the Big East grew very rapidly, and just by showing up, BC and UConn when Calhoun goes there in '86. It's unquestionable that the Big East is the game in town, at least as a brand, and certainly the scrappy play that follows through.
Oh, without question. I mean, certainly, I mean, the Northeastern had a chip on their shoulder relative to BC. They played every year through 85, I think it was, and they would hang in there a lot of times, but they just didn't have quite the talent level that BC did. Conversely, it's kind of a funny thing for BC, who was always perceived within the Big East as having a little bit less talent than their opponents. I'm not sure that's really the case. I mean, BC had a very good track record of producing guys who ended up in the NBA in that time period. I mean, John Bagley had a fantastic NBA career. Michael Adams had a fantastic NBA career. So they may not have been quite as heralded as some of the guys who ended up at, say, Georgetown or St. John's or Villanova, but they did have a lot of fine players. And I think when they played against Northeastern, they just had a little bit too much talent for those Northeastern teams.
How does Calhoun get to Connecticut? What how does he hit the radar of the Huskies? That the sec the Connecticut version.
It happens primarily through the Connecticut Mutual Classic Tournament in November 1985. There's Northeastern, there's UConn, I think there's like Oral Roberts and Wichita State are the four teams in it. And UConn and Northeastern meet in the finals, and Northeastern pummels UConn. UConn had been very good in the late 70s. They'd won that ECAC New England Championship, had some very good players like Corney Thompson who went on to NBA careers. But by the mid-1980s, the UConn program had struggled in recruiting. Partially that's because the likes of Calhoun and Williams at BC were taking a lot of the good players out of Connecticut. And I mean, recruiting some of these guys who would have been in Connecticut's pipeline. And UConn had fallen to the bottom three of the conference. It was really Seton Hall, Providence, and UConn who were the bottom teams in the Big East during its early years. And Dom Perno was a guy who'd been the coach at UConn since the late 70s, was a very popular guy, had been a great player at UConn in the 60s. The athletic director, John Toner, said, enough. If we're going to try to compete in this conference, we need a new coach. And the first place they looked was Jim Calhoun. They were so impressed by the team he'd brought in to play against them. And he gets hired for the next year, largely based on that experience of seeing how strong that team was in that tournament. And he comes in many ways, starts doing exactly what he did at Northeastern. He gets a lot of unheralded players, builds pipelines, gets a lot of good players from Connecticut who previously wouldn't have gone there, got guys from overseas. He had a guy named Nadav Henefeld from Israel, who was the conference player or the Big East newcomer of the year in 89-90, the first time they got a number one seed. He really found a lot of these unconventional recruits, brought them in, and built UConn up very quickly. In terms of the NIT, interestingly, one of the building blocks of the UConn program when Calhoun got there was the NIT. When he interviewed for the job, he cited winning the NIT as being something that would bring the program to more national notice, which they do in 1988. They actually defeat Gary Williams' new team at Ohio State in the finals that year in the 1988 NIT. And the people in stores reacted like they'd won the Super Bowl. I mean, they're burning dorm furniture. They got thousands of people outside, you know, cheering and welcoming the team. I mean, it's remarkable exuberance for winning a tournament that was seen as very much second tier by most people in the late 1980s.
All right. Well, let's back into Patino, because he's probably the most odd character in all of this. Clearly got his cut his teeth with his first head coaching gig in Boston at BU around this time. So a little bit about BU at this period of time. He was kind of I think he had been an assistant at Syracuse for a brief period of time before going to BU. But this is a Queens kid, right? Who or Oyster Bay at least, you know, and played at UMass. He's quite the character, and he's mixing it up with these guys too. And I would argue, how can I best describe this? Is he more, how is he different from these two, arguably iconic, coaches? Because he strikes me still today, this very day, as a bit more, wily, street smart, and or some of the negative connotations with those definitions.
I mean, there's a lot of similarities personality-wise with each of them. I think the thing that strikes me as Patino's defining characteristic is his restlessness. He always wants to try something new, finds a way to come into conflict with people wherever he ends up, it seems like, too. You have Calhoun and Williams who end up at a place, they end up staying there. Guys who never really travel that far from where they're from. You have Gary Williams, he's a guy from New Jersey, who ends up going to Maryland, ends up spending almost the lion's share of his career coaching at Maryland, his alma mater. You have Jim Calhoun. I think Storrs, Connecticut is the furthest away he's ever lived from his hometown of Braintree, Massachusetts. This is a guy who very much has existed within a very small orbit in his life. Patino has just bounced all over from day one. As you mentioned, he's a New Yorker. He grew up in Queens, ended up in Oyster Bay as a teenager, excellent high school player, recruited to UMass, almost immediately gets in a fight with a lot of his teammates because he wants to be the top dog on the team, in spite of there being Dr. J there. There's Al Skinner, has a great career there. Patino ends up, though, becoming an excellent college point guard. A guy who'd wanted to shoot the lights out of the building in high school becomes basically a distributor in his college career, and I think that very much shaped his approach to coaching, that he was always looking for coaches on the floor similar to himself. Billy Donovan, when he coached at Providence, really probably being the best example of that. Patino knew he wanted to get into coaching immediately. His first gig is coaching at Hawaii. Patino was an incredibly well-connected guy from day one because he's part of that first generation of kids that go to Howard Garfinkel's five-star basketball camp. He knows Hubie Brown and Bobby Knight and Chuck Daly and all these guys when he's 16 years old, hanging out with them in the Poconos in the summertime. And that really gets him into this five-star family of coaches almost immediately. He gets a job at Hawaii, which Hawaii turns things around quickly. He ends up being the interim head coach there briefly when he's like 24 years old. There's a scandal which leads to the end of the previous coach's tenure. Patino sort of peripherally is involved in it, but avoids the more serious end of it. He ends up leaving Hawaii very quickly, gets a gig with Boeheim at Syracuse, recruits some. He's a great salesman from day one, recruits Roosevelt Bowie and a lot of other great players to come play at Syracuse in the late 70s. He's 26 years old. He says, I want to get a head coaching job. He sees there's an opening at BU. Boeheim says that is the worst job in the East. BU does not support its athletic programs. It's this historically Methodist school, which is trying to evolve into a more elite kind of private school. Sports are not the focus there. If there's a sport that's the focus, it's hockey. They win national titles in that. They're not going to pay attention to you in basketball. Patino goes up to Boston, talks to the athletic director, and immediately convinces him to double the number of athletic scholarships they offer from 6 to 12 to double his recruiting budget and to give him a car. So Patino proved, as a very young man, he's the youngest coach in the country, proved incredibly persuasive that he could quickly build them a strong basketball program. And he does so almost overnight. He's able to use his five-star connections to bring a lot of good players into BU. He, like the other coaches, is playing a very aggressive style of basketball, very up-tempo style. Patino has got these kids working on basketball 50, 60 hours a week at BU, and there's nobody coming to these games when they play in them. I mean, BU almost immediately is one of the best teams in New England. They get to one NCAA tournament. They go to the NIT twice when he's there in 5 years, and they're getting like 200 people at their games. They just can't draw anybody at BU to be interested. If people are interested in sports there, they're interested in hockey, or they're interested in the pro sports in Boston, or their kids were just simply interested in being in Boston and being a college kid, as opposed to being really into the athletics at their school. So with basically nobody watching, he builds a fantastic basketball program there that is pressing for 40 minutes, running for 40 minutes. The NCAA ends up instituting a rule which comes to be known as the Patino rule, limiting players to 20 hours a week of activity, because Patino, from basically the moment they woke up to the minute they go to bed, is teaching, coaching them in some respect if they're not in class. So Patino just uses tremendous energy and also great basketball IQ, of course, to very quickly build up this BU program. But nobody locally seems to pay attention or notice all that much. Even in his final year at BU, 1982-83, where they go to the NCAA tournament, their best player gets seriously injured 4 games before the end of the season, and they still end up making it to the NCAA tournament. There's just nobody going to their games. They averaged 600 fans per game in the year they made it to the NCAA tournament, and that was the best attendance they ever had during his tenure at BU. So Patino very much is able to have a laboratory where there's nobody watching closely when he's at Boston University, and it becomes the model for how he went on to build other programs in many other places.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and not unlike what he was warned early on, right? That there's not going to be a whole lot of support and stuff. Mm-hmm. And look, BU's still to this day is a very urban kind of campus. It's just like literally it's a strip there, right there on off of Commonwealth. That's, you know, it's a very urban, you know, very small. Not even a sort of college campus footprint kind of thing. Not like an NYU in New York or a GW in D.C. The city is the campus, if you will. And that's a lot of other distractions when a college campus is set up that way. And, you know, it's good or bad, I don't know. It's clear he got he had the itch. And obviously between pro and college back and forth. But, you know, controversially, though, maybe a moment or two about sort of that, because I think, you know, of these three guys, right, that you sort of intertwine in this story, he's the only one that's had a championships vacated.
Yeah, and he seems to make enemies everywhere he goes. And if it happens, I mean, it's part of it. It's got to be a degree of personality conflict. I mean, certainly he's an abrasive guy in a lot of ways. He can be very charming and a great salesman, too. He's the only one of the three guys I didn't talk to for the book. I spoke with Calhoun. Talking with Calhoun was like meeting up with an old buddy at the Elks Club or something. We chatted for like 2 hours, and he remembered like every one of his guys and what they majored in and stuff. Gary Williams, I had a nice interview with him. We chatted maybe 45 minutes. He was very pleasant to talk to. Not like he was your old pal, though. Patino, I just couldn't get through to, despite talking with a lot of his former players who tried to get him to talk to me. I mean, he had a lot going on, certainly. But one thing I will say is the guys who played for Patino at BU still want to run through a brick wall for him. I mean, he really built up strong loyalty among those guys. And my impression is that's been true in a lot of the places he's coached, that the guys he coached actually really genuinely love him. At least a lot of them do. But I think he always wanted to try something new. I mean, he didn't leave BU at a conventional time. In the middle of the summer, he packs up and leaves BU to become the assistant for Hubie Brown with the Knicks. And that all started because he would go to the five-star basketball camp every summer, and he met up with Hubie Brown. And Hubie Brown's top assistant with the Knicks, Mike Fratello, had just left to become the coach of the Atlanta Hawks. So he asked Patino if he wanted to do it. And BU was kind of high and dry in the middle of the summer to find a new coach. They hired a very young and experienced coach named John Kuster, who'd been a point guard on UNC's national championship runner-up team in 77 that lost to Marquette. But I think he just wasn't quite ready to be a head coach. I mean, Patino was a very unique young man, being able to be ready for those pressures. Kuster, who went on to have a long career as an assistant coach and coaching the Pistons for a little bit in the NBA, he just wasn't quite there yet. So he left them in kind of a bad position. Left the Knicks quickly to become the coach at Providence. Leaves Providence quickly to go back to the Knicks. Does very well with the Knicks, as he'd done very well at Providence, and you know, gets in fight with management with the Knicks, and you know, it goes on and on. I mean, it seems like everywhere he goes, he's successful, but ends up, you know, and coming into conflict with a lot of people. I guess it's just his temperament.
Well, give me a sense then. I mean, because obviously each of these guys have gone on to, you know, Hall of Fame careers, and you know, legendary status amongst mostly, he's a little bit of pro with Patino exploits in the game. What do you think, you know, kind of binds these guys together? I mean, they kind of, you know, cut their teeth sort of in the crucible of Boston basketball. I mean, not always overlapping per se, but what is it about sort of the Boston basketball experience that you think kind of just, you know, ties them together? Is it sort of a DNA that sort of got forged there and stuff? Or was it just kind of a unique time that these three legends of the game just kind of, yeah, what was it about Boston per se? And what is it about them that's kind of makes it all stand out?
I think these are three very ambitious young men who all got coaching jobs at quite a young age, who were able to try different things out a little bit under the radar. I think even BC being in the Big East, it was a little different than some of the other Big East programs in terms of the degree of focus on them. Despite all the success they had, it was always, every year it was like a big surprise that BC had a good team. I think because Boston was so much a pro sports town, despite being perceived as America's college town, you have lots of these little colleges. There's not one specific college that gets most of the fealty of the public. It's not like Ann Arbor, Michigan is a college town or Madison's a college town. It's a different kind of a college town with a lot of these different schools. In this very much pro sports town, they're able to work in the shadow of the Celtics and develop programs and build programs up using distinct and a bit unusual recruiting pipelines in each case, and apply a little bit different style of ball than what was being played in a lot of other places, a style that had been played in the Northeast by City College and Holy Cross and the original New York Celtics, and later the kind of Cousy Celtics that had played in a somewhat similar style, but sort of taking something old stylistically, making use of the opportunity they had in a degree of anonymity, and taking advantage of all of this to build up their programs. I don't think it was anything particularly in the water in Boston. I think it just provided them a context to do this.
Yeah, and they also got their they also got to play, and now Patino again. They also got to play in the highest form of that game, that being the Big East, right? I mean, the earlier years of the Big East, right, were just short of legendary. I mean, some of the players, the style of play, the big city urban buzz of it all. You know, these guys, you know, really kind of started showing in the spotlights, bringing their own league lights with them.
Absolutely. And it's just such a different era too, in terms of players being in college for 4 years. So many of these guys, I mean, Chris Mullin, Pinckney, Ewing, Michael Adams, these guys had these seemingly very long college careers relative to guys now, that there's like a narrative arc to their career, as opposed to it being snapshots from one particular season. And I think as a result of that, that's part of the legendary status, that it's not just a particular season in which these guys were good, but it's a period of time that you had all these great players overlapping and playing against one another.
All right. Well, let's fast forward to now. I mean, you know, we kind of covered a lot of ground here, and obviously these guys are, you know, icons of the game, despite their various personality idiosyncrasies and whatnot. Were there at the founding, if you will, or part of the earliest years of the Big East, and the tributaries that sort of helped create this Big East thing with the old ECAC and but it's also a reflection, right, of where college basketball has come from, right? Especially in the last 30 years or so, with the advent of television, big money. I mean, college coaches, you know, in both of the major money sports, right, are in many cases, at least at the state levels, the highest paid public servants in their respective states, right? Mm-hmm. I think television is certainly one of the biggest generators of all this stuff, but I don't think even they at that time in the 70s, early 80s could have even imagined what a behemoth this college sports thing and basketball in particular and the tournament, right, has become in terms of money and industry, shall we say. Are these guys part of the buildup of that, or are they just kind of stories that just came along for that ride? I mean, it's hard to look back on some of these stories in their earliest days and not wax a little nostalgic for, I wouldn't call it the good old days, but certainly a little bit more had a purity of game and maybe a purpose. And you even mentioned it too, players that stayed around for 3 or 4 years, God forbid. What's changed in all this? How much would you say these guys were part of that, or they were just sort of stories that stood out as just being part of that fabric?
I mean, they strike me as being the beneficiaries of these broader cultural economic changes that are going on that make college basketball a big deal. I mean, you need great coaches who are there year after year. You need personalities. I mean, there's Gary Williams just sweating through a suit every game. This very intense figure with that Gary Williams scowl. He's for years a character. Even if people just watch March Madness, he was this recurring character on television for many years. There's acerbic Jim Calhoun. There's, kind of know-it-all Patino, who's, you know, kind of a classic kind of like New York City, big mouth, big shot kind of guy. I mean, they're all larger than life characters. And I think that they, having guys like that, made it a game that was more easily accessible for a lot of fans. In terms of the changes that have happened in the game, I mean, it would be interesting to see if these guys were a generation younger, how they would have done. I mean, one assumes people are a product of their time, and I think they would have adapted to the changes. But it would have come in a very different form. I mean, these were three of the leading characters in a generation full of coaches that were very, very colorful characters. I think if anything, I sort of feel like a lot of the coaches of the current generation don't stand out as much. And I would say this as somebody who watches probably more college basketball now as a 42-year-old than I did when I was 10, and I loved college basketball when I was 10. I mean, maybe it's because I'm watching so many different teams around the country that they don't, as opposed to, I feel like every weekend for like 15 years in the wintertime, I'm not a Georgetown fan. I would watch a Georgetown basketball game. Like, I felt like I knew John Thompson. I knew Alonzo Mourning. I knew Sleepy Floyd. In a way, it's just so much different now with just how quickly things pass with the current era of college basketball.
Yeah, look, and I'm having gone to Georgetown undergrad and having, you know, the embarrassment of riches, right, and that unique John Thompson, you know, led kind of dynamic of a program, and to see where it is now, you know, it is, and frankly, how different even within the last number of years the game has become with NIL and the advent of legalized betting in a lot of states, or at least on the national level, being condoned. And frankly, just the players' rights, I guess, right, in terms of their ability to kind of take their show on the road. Now, I get it from a player's perspective. You see the big money. There's a lot of television dough that players haven't benefited from, and all that kind of stuff. So in many respects, right, that's sort of a, you know, finally allowing the players to actually benefit from all these, you know, all these good, you know, growing entities and enterprises. But I think a lot of the soul of college basketball gets lost. And I think being a college coach right now in any sport of that makes money, basketball and football in particular, has just got to be, besides the big paychecks, right, the other side of that is, and I think Ed Cooley's experiencing that now, having come from Providence. I think even he's starting to wonder why he decided to come to Georgetown, right? At the time, it was a great idea. It's a great idea for Patino to be in the mix and then go to St. John's. Both of them, I think, have a major headache given just how dramatically different the game is right now. And if you don't recruit like now for next year and then again for the year after, it's almost like running for Congress. You're going to be gone in a year or two. These kids aren't going to stay around.
Yeah, to me, of all the things, the transfer portal is the one I've had the hardest time wrapping my head around, just not knowing who's going to be on what teams. Since I was about probably 7 years old, and this is true, I mean, I'm as big a college football fan as I'm a college basketball fan. Since I was about 7 years old, my birthday is in late July. My mom would buy me a college football preview every year, and does to this day for my birthday. That's what she gets me, is a college football preview. I get it now. I look. The roster that I see on there has almost nothing to do with the roster which we'll be playing, in a Big Ten game in the first week of September. I mean, it's sort of a relic by the time I receive by the time I receive one. With college basketball previews, it's true too. I get one like usually like mid-October. I buy one, and the teams, it's not the same team kind of thing. I mean, I find it. I've never been a person who's enjoyed following recruiting. It's always just seemed like a kind of sausage making that's never really appealed to me as a fan. But now I feel like I have to be concerned with it all the time in a way that I just find, I sort of like, this is my team, these are the guys we brought in, and I find it very disconcerting as a fan.
Yeah, I do too, and I'm not trying to be the old man yelling at the clouds. I'm a progressive guy. Don't get me wrong, and there's certainly many nuances and evolutions of the game and the sports and all that kind of stuff, and I embrace a whole lot of them. But I mean, and I think it's got to be impossibly difficult, especially for basketball coaches in college, to recruit. And what do you have in your arsenal? Right, seemingly it's not a full ride. College education. Seemingly, it's not the culture or the uniqueness of the campus or the school pride and any of those other intangibles. Right now, it's like it's money that arguably was, in the system years ago, but now has been somewhat legalized, which still is odd with boosters and all that kind of stuff. But who am I to argue, the kids getting paid for the first time, but. Literally, it's kind of like a syndicate now, where kids can literally go and hop against four different places, and maybe even a fifth or sixth with a waiver or two. It is it's a real it's like a rental, really, more than anything else. And I don't know how a coach can stabilize a program or grow into anything when they constantly have to go to the portal, like the second the season ends. And reconstitute something. I mean, I guess it's exciting to be able to do that with a new squad every year, but there's zero consistency to it.
Yeah, I mean, every team sort of feels like an AAU team at the college level to me
There
now, in
you
a
go.
way. I mean, I remember watching one of those, it was a documentary about Calipari that ESPN had a few years, but it was before COVID and stuff, and before, I mean, Kentucky's, things aren't quite the way they were there. But he said, he'd have the five best, like, incoming players in the country. He's like, fine, but every year is a rebuilding year. I mean, he was kind of unique at that time, but every single program in the country is facing that now, that there's every single season is that trying to acculturate these players to the style of play you want and getting them to even just know each other. I don't envy the position the coaches are in.
All right, where do you think it's going to go in the next couple of years in your crystal ball? And do you miss, well, I guess it's hard to miss it already, but the NIT is a shell of its former self. It's not even a Madison Square Garden anymore. Clearly, it's sunsetting from its its New York City-ness, and its heritage and all that kind of stuff. What of the NIT? What do you think of the NCAA tournament? Are we going to go to 128 teams? When does this end, and or are we sort of, is it going to break, given all the other things that are going on with all the money and the NIL and that kind of stuff? Because in my mind, this is almost, I don't know, it feels like we're nearing a precipice here that we don't know what's going to be on the other side, relatively soon.
Part of me, well, I guess with my heart is broken about the NIT. I mean, the minute the NCAA got their claws into it, I knew they would just ruin everything, and they've done exactly as I expected. I mean, it's just no, nothing can be unique in particular. It's got to be just part of the whole system. It just galls me what's happened with the NIT. In terms of college basketball more broadly, I kind of hope that college football gets so bizarre that college football will be that there will be a universe that's like the three dozen teams that are great college football teams are like their own universe. The rest of college football goes back to being like it was, and then college basketball will be left alone to be college basketball as it was in the past, is my hope. I mean, I don't know what to expect. I'm trying to be optimistic about it, but I sort of just hope I that college football just gets so weird that it enables the rest of college athletics to kind of go back to being college athletics.
Well, I hope you're right. I don't know though. I mean, there's some real serious talk about expanding this NCAA tournament to 128 teams.
I hate that. So I hate the 68. I think that stinks. Let's go back.
Yeah, I think at least that's competitive, right? And yeah, I mean, I could see, but it's all been driven by money and television contracts, and frankly, the whole television is exploding and changing and stuff. So I'm not even sure that that money, which has been the stalwart and the pump, if you will, of inflation of all the riches in this game, is, I'm not sure that's even sustainable. That's why I worry about sort of what might happen once some of that air sort of starts to leak out of the system. I don't know where all that other money is going to come from. Is that from gaming? Is that from what?
I don't know. I mean, and then the NBA is talking about expanding again. I don't know. I don't know what to think. I mean, I certainly don't want a 128 team tournament. I mean, just so devaluing something that's so special for so many schools. I mean, to me, I feel like I enjoy conference championship, the couple of weeks of that. I enjoy that more now than I enjoy the NCAA tournament. I mean, to me, it's just fun to turn on whatever random championship game it is and just see what a significant moment it is for those teams. That feels a lot more like college basketball as I perceive it. I mean, watching, you know, LIU play against Drew or somebody for a bid to the tournament, I think that's fantastic television. I just the most so many rounds that almost seem like mousetrap in these huge conference tournament, you know, the ACC tournament or whatever, goes on for seems like 9 days or something now, and you know, it's tough to keep, for me it's tough to keep track of what's going on in those things.
No, I think that's right. And sadly at that. All right. Time to promote. Tell us, the book's been out for a little while. What's the reception been? And frankly, what else do you have up your sleeve, you think, in the realm of sports? If anything, are you going to take a break?
My book is called Boston Ball, Rick Pitino, Jim Calhoun, Gary Williams, and the Forgotten Cradle of Basketball Coaches. It's from the University of Nebraska Press. It's available on all the well-known Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the well-known websites. If you go to the book's website, which is bit.ly, bit.ly/BostonBall, and use promo code 6AF23, you can save 40% off the cover price. And if you get in touch with me on social media, I'm on Facebook, Clayton Truder. I'm on Twitter, at Clayton Truder. Send me a note, say you bought the book. I'll be happy to send you a book plate as thanks. In terms of the book's reception, I've heard a lot of positive things. One thing that's been great is just hearing from a lot of the former players from this era, whether I interviewed them or not, getting in touch with me, telling me they thought I did a good job presenting the time period with complexity, and their endorsement to me has been the most rewarding part of having done the book. I've done a lot of radio spots for the book, and yeah, it's gotten some attention, and hopefully during March Madness it gets another bump. In terms of what I'm doing, I teach at Norwich University in Vermont. I do a ton of freelance writing on the side. I write, if you go to my website, claytontruder.com, or follow me on social media, I write for a wide range of venues. I write about sports, I write about music, I write about films. I write, some of the venues I write for is our Next Avenue PBS, which is aimed at 50 plus adults. I write for the Hockey News fairly regularly, typically historical pieces. I write for a lot of city and regional magazines. In terms of a book, I have an idea. I'm trying to get a deal for it, and a publisher and the like.
You're not going to jinx it now, huh?
No, I'm not going to jinx it now.
Is it in the realm of sports?
It is in the realm of sports, and it's a sport I haven't written about yet in book form. So,
I guess we're just going to have to guess. Well, will you let us know, especially if it hits our radar, if indeed it starts to get going, and if we can be of help in the
absolutely.
Process?
Absolutely, yes.
Do you think it'll hit our radar? That's the last question I'll ask on it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right, that's good. All right, so now I'm intrigued. Indeed, a pleasure to have Mr. Truder back here on these microphones, and we thank him for joining us. One more time, the book is called Boston Ball, Rick Pitino, Jim Calhoun, Gary Williams, and the Forgotten Cradle of Basketball Coaches, written by our guest this week, Clayton Truder, published by our good friends at the University of Nebraska Press, and available for purchase for you at your local bookseller, your independent bookseller. Go ahead and keep them in business. Why don't you have them order it if they don't have it already on their shelves? Or you can keep us in business, literally, by going to our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. Search up this episode number 342 with Clayton Truder, and you will find a couple of convenient links to either the hardcover or Kindle versions of Boston Ball. And we'll get a couple of shekels of referral love. We appreciate that. And we think you'll enjoy that book tremendously, and hopefully a nice little companion piece to the current doings of the NCAA March Madness now ongoing as we record this. While you're online, why not go to our website there at goodseatsstillavailable.com and tool around, see all the other episodes that we've done and will do in the future. You can stream them and share them and do whatever you like with them there. Of course, subscribe and follow us wherever you get podcasts. That's the best way to ensure that you don't miss a thing around here. But while you're on our website, you can buy us a proverbial cup of coffee if you'd like through our friends at Ko-Fi. There's a nice little button there. And you'd like to send us a couple of bucks just as a little tip or as a thank you, or if you want to give us a little bit of attaboy, if you will, on a monthly basis or just a one-timer or whatever, we certainly appreciate that too. We don't charge a lot around here for this show, and we appreciate all your cards and letters, of course, but if you feel like you can support the show in some way, shape, or form by a little monetary donation, we wouldn't turn you away, and we appreciate that very much. And it's the least we can do for you around here. Let's see. While there, you can also follow our social media feeds, convenient links to those. But if you're scoring at home, you'll go to Twitter/X. You'll find us at Good Seats Still. You'll find us at Good Seats Still Available at all these other places like Threads and Instagram and Facebook and I guess wherever else. Send us some email, why don't you, at hello@goodseatsstillavailable.com. We do our best to respond as quickly as possible. Our apologies if we haven't got back to you yet. And our thanks, as always, to our good friend, Jerry Payne. Jerry Payne Audio Excellence in the Atlanta metropolitan area. Appreciate your knob twiddling again this week, sir. Thank you. And good luck to all with your brackets, and hopefully none have fully busted yet. And enjoy the rest of the hoops. And we will see you, God willing, next week. Take care of yourselves, and happy hoopin'.